comes this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
I know what you're thinking. Mine's bigger than yours, right? Isn't that fair? Throw it away. All right? All right!
Got tons of popcorn there.
Yeah.
And all you gotta do is go climb a tree to go eat it.
It was a night like any other night. Then something happened.
Oh, good Lord. It's unbelievable. It's horrible.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 178, 1988, Canadian cult classic, Pin.
Yeah, I don't know whether we should call this a cult classic, whether we should call this an underseen masterpiece. I would call it more of an underseen masterpiece. I mean, it's funny when people refer to something as a cult classic. In your opinion, Chris, what makes something a cult classic? I mean, that term has been bandied about so often. I mean, you have your genuine cult classics, you know, your Rocky Horror Picture Shows, and your Phantom of the Paradises and whatnot, Pink Flamingos, you know, but what makes...
Jeez, well, that term seems to cast a pretty long shadow. Uh-huh. I would say any movie that is not widely seen but continues to carry on a life of its own through younger and younger iterations of people. And so it's frequently used to describe things that no one's seen. So in this, I would hasten to say that, you know, maybe Pin? How many people have seen
Pin? Well, that's the whole thing, because...
So, I mean, I don't even know if this would qualify.
There you go, because I don't think... I mean, there isn't any sort of, like, Pin revivals or Pin conventions going on. It's a movie that those that have seen it have extremely fond memories of it. It is slowly being rediscovered by younger audiences, but it's not a phenomenon like some of these modified cult classics. Mind you, some of these cult classics are manufactured many a time. I'll see a new movie being released, and you'll see the tagline on the DVD box, an instant cult classic. Mm. That is completely bullshit. For a cult has to grow organically, and something cannot be deemed a classic until it's been out there in the public consciousness for, I would say, at least a decade, if not longer, and it has to be renewed and rediscovered and reassessed. For example, I'll give you a cult classic to me would be Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. When that movie first came out, and I believe it was 82 or 83, it was completely vilified by both critics and audiences because Carpenter had the notion that he was done with the story of Michael Myers, and he wanted to continue Halloween as a yearly anthology with different stories. But audiences were not ready for that. They wanted to see more hack and slash from Michael Myers, and the movie was completely vilified. Critics destroyed it, audiences ignored it, and yet, as years have gone on, a cult has formed around the film, and people at this point are now saying it's amazing. It's totally different than what you would expect as far as Halloween movies go, but it's an incredible story. And that, to me, is an organic cult classic. And it's funny because they still write articles saying, oh, Halloween 3, it's a good movie. It's actually a good movie. Well, you know what? Fuck that. It's accepted. It's a good movie. Nobody thinks that it's a bad movie anymore. It's been reassessed as a good movie. Phantom of the Paradise, another good example of a cult classic in the sense that it didn't get its due when it was first released, and we've talked about this before. The only, you know, it was competing against Rocky Horror Picture Show for that sort of musical horror
crossover. Yeah.
And far superior work, but it didn't get the same sort of traction. It didn't get the audience participation sort of thing. And really, Winnipeg's the only place that embraced it. But as years have gone on, people have realized that, hey, man, this is the real deal. Now, when it comes to pin, I don't believe there's a cult of pin. I haven't seen anybody wearing pin t-shirts or getting pin tattoos or going to pin, talk along with pin screenings or whatever.
So there's no pinhead fan group?
Well, there's a pinhead fan group, but
no,
it's not...
No, pinheads, they would be fans of pin.
See, but that's the other... I know. But what pin is a totally underseen masterpiece. One of those movies that should be much more lauded in the horror space than it is. As I said before, those who have seen it appreciate it, and unfortunately, a lot of people have yet to discover the joys of Pin. And the other thing about Pin, too, is that it's an interesting film in the sense that it may not reach out to you the first time you see it. I recall the first time me seeing this movie, and I don't think it did anything for me. And we've talked about this many times. We talked about how you can revisit a movie years later, and it resonates completely differently from when you first watch it. And a lot of this has to do with expectations. A lot of this has to do with the
surroundings.
I'm thinking back to, I'd say, over a decade ago. I was working at a library. Of course, libraries also let out DVDs and cassettes. And anything horror-related...
I snapped up.
And one of them was Pin. And I took it home, popped it in after my shift... And it just didn't really resonate with me in any way, shape, or form. However, I know that a lot of people whom I respect, love Pin. So when it was suggested by you to do it for the podcast, I was extremely excited to revisit it. And this viewing experience was the complete antithesis of my first experience. With my first experience, I just sort of kind of watched the movie and was like, This time I was riveted from frame one to the last, and I absolutely loved it. So, to sum up my long-winded rant, cult classic, I don't know. Does it deserve a cult? Perhaps. Is it a classic? I think it is, but it's certainly an underseen masterpiece.
Yeah, the guys over at Canucksploitation, they have a really cool site, and they are, I think, if not one of the few, maybe the only site that is exclusively devoted to propping up these underseen masterpieces. And there's so many interesting Canadian low-budget films. Like, I just saw The Vindicator, which is like a proto-roto... say that three times fast. A proto-robocop. It came out the year before, and then there's a movie called The Tower, which is a green energy building that turns on its occupants by zapping them and whatnot. You know, it goes haywire, the system breaks down, and these are movies that are made with incredible budget constraints, and Pin falls in the same category. It's toward the tail end of the tax shelter era, not even part of it.
I was going to say, this was probably, because a lot of the Canadian horror films that are lauded nowadays came out of that tax shelter era, but I'm pretty sure that the era had ended. No, this was after the tax shelter era, so Canadian horror was no longer being churned out, you know.
Being funded.
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned the budget constraints and the austerity and so on. I mean, that's what makes Pin so incredible, because this is an uber-creepy movie. And yet, there's really not one special effect, no blood, nothing. No cheap jump scares. Everything was done organically, and the scares just were done by filmmaking ingenuity, and also extremely good characterization, where you really identified, emulated, what have you, with the situation. And let's be honest here, Pin himself, let's describe Pin.
Pin is a medical dummy, an anatomical educational device that's used by this, I think his name is Dr. Linden.
Dr. Frank Linden, yeah.
Frank Linden, as an instructional aide, and he's just one of these, the muscles are exposed, he's sort of a plastic, just rendering.
Well, he's a translucent anatomical dummy with an extremely creepy countenance, extremely weird, blank,
weird,
expressionless face, which is very interesting. Because the face is so expressionless, I mean, there are times in the movie, and this is even before there's a fabrication of skin on Pin, but there are times in the movie where Pin looks decidedly malevolent, decidedly evil, and the expression is not changing at all.
Yeah.
But the audience is projecting how they feel Pin should be onto the face of Pin.
And that's amplified by the incredibly quiet, whispering voice that's just absolutely spot on.
And I'm saving that about the voice till What Do We Learn, because I learned something very interesting about the voice of Pin, which I will discuss later on. So we have this doctor, Dr. Frank Linton, and he's got two children. He's got a son, and he's got a daughter. And the daughter's name is Ursula, and the son's name is...
Leon.
And when the doctor is practicing, he keeps asking Pin questions, and Pin is talking back to him. And the movie does not say anything, in a sense, like, you know, who's hearing Pin? Is he really speaking? We surmise later on that it is ventriloquism, that the doctor's using ventriloquism to have the voice of Pin be emitted, but it's not explicitly said so you kind of feel like you're like, is anybody really listening to Pin? Can people hear Pin? Is the doctor deluded? Are the kids deluded? Yeah. What have you? But it doesn't matter, because you have this anatomical dummy with this really soft, creepy voice talking about, I don't know, appendicitis and different sort of stuff. And the kids are... Is this medically feasible, where if you're examining another patient, you can have your kids in the...
Oh my God, well, yeah, it's not only used as instructional aid for medical students, maybe at McGill University, this is filmed in Montreal, but yeah, the kids get a little lesson in anatomy in one of the film's many sexual, creepy scenes where young Ursula is shown the male anatomy, and she removes, I think, a white towel that's covering Pin's lower extremities, and then she giggles. So there's lots of this.
Well, that's yeah, it. Yeah, there's a lot of psychosexual stuff. I mean, first of all, Pin is modest. He's wearing a, I guess it's a towel.
A loincloth.
There's a scene, because the children are not meant to speak to Pin without Daddy present, obviously, because Daddy is throwing his voice. But there's a scene where the son Leon stays behind, and he witnesses the nurse doing something quite, you know, perverted with
good
Pin.
Night nurse, huh?
And yeah, that was basically sowed the seeds for a lot of sexual repression in
sowing the seeds Leon. For what they call in the movie the need. Yeah.
So then, as the movie continues, the kids grow older, and Ursula goes from being sort of like a young, innocent little girl to being, for lack of a better term...
Hot?
Well, hot, yeah. But I was like somebody who, I guess, whose sexual proclivities are a little bit more...
Pronounced. Yeah, yeah.
And she gets herself pregnant. And she confides in...
Or someone gets her pregnant, to be technical.
Well, yes, exactly. The passive risk and so on. Yeah. But, yeah, she confides in her brother, and they said, we got to talk to Pin. Pin will tell us what to do. And at this point, Pin is talking to the kids without Daddy present. So Pin says, you have to talk to Daddy, because Daddy is a man of science, he's a clinical man, he will take emotion out of this. And they get the birds and the bees talk from Pin. And that's just super creepy.
Yeah.
And that's when Pin brings up the concept of the need. So to add to the creepiness, yes, Pin was correct, and Daddy is super clinical, and he performs an abortion on his daughter.
Yeah, none of which is... this is all just referenced and not seen. I mean, they really don't pull back the curtain on anything. Everything is just acknowledged just to forward the plot. And Leon becomes a surrogate father, as does Pin, to Ursula, and he's incredibly protective subsequent to her abortion and pregnancy. And so that every guy who gets within couple feet of her, he just steps right in, and so he's always interceding, you know, in the middle of her relationships.
Well, it's not just that, but we can surmise that I think this traces back to when he witnessed the nurse getting on with Pin, which begs the question: is Pin erect? I'm asking you.
I don't even know. I'm stunned.
You're stunned.
Yeah, I'm gonna spit my coffee out. Okay. I never.
Well, I mean, I think he. Anyway, forget. Let's not talk about the turgidity of a plastic.
The two messages of the plastic, the dummy.
There is repression there because of what he witnessed probably before he was ready. He witnessed a female doing something with. I mean, you got to remember, like, he totally anthropomorphizes Pin and believes that Pin is sentient in many a way. And he's all in, whereas everybody else in the family, including Ursula, they, I mean, they're pretty much have cottoned on to the fact that, you know, this is Daddy who speaks through Pin, and the mother, she's totally, she hates Pin. The reality is that Leon is a little bit deranged, and he fully believes that Pin is has sentience and can talk and so on, and it's revealed later on that he has certain psychological disorders which cause him to have that belief. But he says to Ursula after she gets pregnant and everything that if you ever do it again, you can forget I'm your brother. So he is very, very anti-sex. Now, ultimately, the parents perish in a car accident. So now we have
two surrogate fathers almost. You have you have Pin and Leon acting as sort of a custodian to Ursula, watching out for her as she, well, you mentioned you worked in a library. She begins to work part-time in a library, and there's this gentleman who starts frequenting the place solely to chat her up.
And that's something that Leon is sort of, he doesn't really approve of. He says, well, we have plenty of money, you know, Daddy left us this estate, why do you have to go to work? But she wants to have some semblance of a normal life. She wants a relationship, she wants work, whereas Leon is content to stay home honing his culinary excellence. And
He has designs on being, what, some cordon bleu, and at one time cooks a coq au vin, which I've never actually eaten, but sounds delightful. And, he just, again, another relationship is blossoming, he wants to quash. And the suitor, in this case, is a collegiate fellow named, one of the few debits in this film. He's meant to be a basketball player, and yet, and a jock type, but yet he's pretty sensitive, and it doesn't make really any sense, unless this is Leon sort of projecting and I don't know, an excuse to badmouth him as a jock, but he's hardly much of a jock, this Stan guy.
Why would you equate a jock to not be sensitive?
I'm not sure.
Jocks can have sensitivity.
Maybe in the groin, yeah, when they get kicked. I don't know. I guess, well, it's just a common movie trope where you rarely, I don't want to say never, I'm trying to think of some examples, but you rarely see someone, you know, who's curious and intellectual and inquisitive, who is, you know, wears varsity jackets and stuff. True enough. Generally just a rapist, meathead, drunkard, and you see this all the time in horror films.
Now, the thing is,
Night of the Demon or something.
Now, the thing is, I guess we're somewhat spoiling it by saying that it's most likely ventriloquism that is making Pin speak, because after, first of all, when Ursula hears Pin's voice for the first time, without Daddy present, she expressed shock and, oh my god, how did you do that? But it wasn't shock, like, how did you get Pin to talk? It was more like, how did you do the ventriloquism in order to get Pin to talk? But one thing that's very interesting is the voice of Pin does change, and it becomes decidedly more aggressive, decidedly more evil, although there are times when Pin, it depends on the situation. Sometimes Pin, but even when he speaks whisper quiet, there's a threatening element to it. And there's any sort of interloper into their little household is going to be dealt with. There's an aunt.
Aunt Dorothy, who is, I guess, the surrogate mom when the parents die in a crash, and she's kind of controlling in a way that probably Dr. Linden would have wanted her to be, and this does not sit well with Pin, who orchestrates her demise, because he's been relegated to some dusty attic, where we were first introduced to him in a gable in the top of this house, so he doesn't really care for the fact that He's being shunted aside, so he wants to end this, and there's a little power struggle for, I guess, dominion over the family between him and Aunt Dorothy.
Yep.
And it's not going to turn out well for Dorothy.
And it should be noted as well that at this point, later on in the film, the relationship is starting to blossom between Ursula and her boyfriend,
Stan.
Leon has taken upon himself to not only dress Pin up in one of Daddy's suits, but to also fabricate some synthetic skin and a wig, and so and Pin is sitting at the dinner table with him. I mean, he's part of the family, and Ursula is. See, this is really a psychological horror movie, and Ursula knows that there's something not quite right with her brother, but she humors him because she loves her brother. And when Stan is brought home for dinner, he's talking to Pin. Nice to meet you, Pin. I've heard so much about you, etc. And you know you. this is something that, again, you is implied, is that he was coached beforehand. Like, listen, my brother's a bit off, so, you know, just humor my brother, talk to Pin, make sure everything. But another interesting thing that happens is, I mean, these are both, you know, growing kids, and they're, you know, in their late teens, perhaps, and Leon himself expresses the fact that he has the need, and he makes a date for himself.
Yes, and but of course, the domineering Pin puts the kibosh on that, not directly, but by inference, once again, where he cannot concentrate on the act of making love to this very attractive young woman in a bedroom, because he even brings up the fact that Pin frequently will open the door, and she has her top off by then and says that, with disgust, like, why don't you just put a chair there, and, you know, and or lock it or something. And he's clearly repressed, and he doesn't give in to his needs as readily as his sister does. I mean, yeah, geez, the sibling sexual dynamics between these two put it more in the camp of, like, Cronenberg's Dead Ringers or something. Like, it has no... This is very unique beast, as you said. No blood, very little gore to speak of, but intense sexual dynamics that really make it... put it over the top.
Yeah, and to make things even more uncomfortable, and besides cooking, another thing that Leon fancies himself out as is a writer, and he writes poetry. And Stan...
Yeah, he's subjected to it, Ursula, yeah, over dinner, yeah.
Encouraged him to read some of their poetry, and he's writing this, like, epic poem along the lines of Beowulf or something like that. And the character, he's like, he's saying, okay, well, at this point, this is going to happen. And what he's reading is about the main character.
Testes. Testes is the main character. Testes. Sounds like a Greek god, yeah.
Yeah, testes, testicles, etc. Yeah. Raping his sister. So this is something that, obviously, again, implied, but... You know, it's not too difficult to surmise that these are the fantasies of Leon coming out through his pen. So Stan, who very much cares for Ursula and wants to have a long-term relationship with her, he said, "Listen, you got to get him psychiatric help. I mean, this kid ain't right. I mean, now he's writing poems about raping you and et cetera, et cetera." And she's like, I can't do it. He's my brother. I love him. I can't have him institutionalized. I know he's sick, but... And Leon overhears this, and obviously Leon is not going to go quietly into the good night. And I think that's about all I want to say, because I don't want to spoil too much of this movie, because
for sure,
there's so much to it in terms of layers of creepiness, psychosexual dynamics, psychological repression, Freudian dynamics, and so on.
So, do we get into what we've learned?
Well, there's a few things I learned. I mean, first of all, a lot of this movie sort of reminded me, in many ways, I mean, it's not, again, it's not an homage, it's not a ripoff, but there's an allusion, in my opinion, to Psycho. Because the character of Leon uses Pin... I mean, okay, let me backtrack just a bit. Both Norman Bates and Leon are two sexually repressed characters. Both of them have needs and urges which they don't know how to express in a healthy way. Both of them fear the need, so to speak. And both of them use a surrogate to...
commit their acts.
To commit their acts, and also to give voice to their ultimate phobias and anxieties. I mean, in Psycho, you have Norman Bates using his mother, his dead mother at this point, spoiler alert. And in Pin, you have Leon using this anatomical dummy. I believe that. And also, I mean, the other interesting thing is that in many ways, Leon and Norman Bates are both sympathetic characters, I feel. I mean, despite the fact that Leon is pretty much the antagonist of this movie, unless you want to call Pin the antagonist, but I guess maybe I'm saying too much, but Leon and Pin are both one. They're the antagonist of the film, but there is something there. You do feel for Leon, and perhaps it's just the performance of the actor, whose name escapes me at the moment, who plays Leon, but there is some sympathy that you have, the audience has for him. There is a little bit of empathy that you have for him. As much as you empathize with the play of poor Ursula, and you want her to escape the clutches of her controlling brother, and you want her to have a healthy relationship with Stan, you also feel for what... And I think a lot of this is a function of seeing them brought up as kids to, you know, through prepubescence, through birthing adulthood, and you see how they were brought up by their father. This whole pin thing was not healthy from the very start. So yeah, there is sympathy for the character. That's one thing I learned. The other thing I learned is, and this is what I was going to say about the voice of Pin. So I'm watching the credits of the movie, watching the credits full through, going through the actors, and then it says, and Jonathan Banks is the voice of Pin. And then I'm going, wait, no, that can't be Jonathan Banks. And I said, there must be another actor named Jonathan Banks. And I IMDb'd it, and lo and behold, it was the Jonathan Banks, who most people know now for playing Mike Ehrmantraut on Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul.
Oh, well.
He's this grizzled, tough ex-cop turned assistant to a drug dealer. But I mean, the thing about Jonathan Banks, I mean, he's old now, but he plays a character that you takes no shit from anybody, and you don't want to mess with him. I mean, he's a phenomenal actor, absolutely phenomenal. He's great in both shows. Better Call Saul is pretty much 50-50, the character telling us about the story of Saul, prequel before Breaking Bad, and the story of Mike. I could not believe that 30 years earlier, this same actor, who I admire so much on these two shows, for playing a completely, wildly divergent character, was the voice of this weird anatomical dummy in some small little Canadian production. It's not mentioned. I mean, Jonathan Banks has a long filmography, despite the fact that he really only came to prominence and to my attention when I started watching Breaking Bad. But yeah, he's been around for a while, and this is something that I don't think he
acknowledges
much. I mean, you know, on his resume. But yeah, that shocked the hell out of me that Jonathan Banks was the voice of Pin. Amazing.
I learned a lot, actually. So when you got the evil brother, which is a trope that goes back to, well, in this movie cites Beowulf. I'm not sure if there's an evil brother in Beowulf, but you can go back to Osiris and Set, Cain and Abel. So evil brother has been told numerous times, I don't think quite in this fashion. The coming of age sexual stuff, when we see young Ursula talking in the very explicitly about sex with her brother, and she queries him about whether their parents, before they do it, whether the mother washes his schlong with spick and span. I thought, this is really fucking twisted, really bizarre.
Oh, yeah, because the mother's a neat freak. That's not a thing.
Yeah.
She's got a bit of, this thing plays with a lot of psychological ailments and maladies and whatnot, and you could surmise that the mother had obsessive compulsive disorder because everything is covered in plastic, all the furniture,
yeah,
and any sort of stain or spillage, she goes apeshit. So yeah.
Yeah, and the late Dr. Linden was a taskmaster control freak, and before bed, the two of them would be put through their paces with mathematical problems to solve, and I think Leon was given the harder task. So before,
well, he's older brother, right?
Yeah, before bed, you have to count backwards from 100 minus 7 each time. It's almost like some DUI test, I wouldn't know. And it was really weird. Also, like, the character of Leon, I don't know if the actor, but he was channeling a little bit. I got a little bit of a Robert Pattinson vibe from him. I don't know if you saw that a little bit, maybe his lower mouth. It was really terrific performance. They really steely. He adopts some of his father's mannerisms.
He's very proper.
Yep. Everywhere. He doesn't go anywhere without a tie and a crisp dress shirt, even when he's cooking Coco Van in this sprawling mansion. He's just really proper, really repressed, really tightwad, and just one of the many things I learned. But
the one thing about the father, I mean, yes, I mean, before bed, I mean, he does quiz his kids with but he's not such a taskmaster that if they get the answer wrong, he won't
let
them
go to bed.
He said, okay, we'll try again. And by the way, the father's played by Terry O'Quinn, who played the titular role in The Stepfather. So he was, I guess, the American actor brought in to sort of juice the box office receipts.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, as this, going back to it once again, a father using this really creepy anatomical dummy to relate the birds and the beasts to his kids. I mean, that's not exactly good parenting. The mother was sort of off her rocker. So there was some, you know, psychological damage from the very beginning. There was the repression of, the sexual repression based upon what young Leon witnessed with the nurse vis-a-vis Pin in the office. But ultimately, I don't know where I'm going with this, but saying that, yeah, the die was cast at a very young age, and it's interesting how, you know, the age-old debate, nature versus nurture, and both these kids have the same upbringing, the same parentage, but they went in two very different directions.
Well, which direction are we going to go in for giving this a rating? Because I think we really both like this a lot. 3.5 for me, I think.
I'm going to give it 4 stars.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. As I said before, the first time I saw it, this film did nothing for me. This time around, I was riveted. I was amazed. I was completely not only that, but the older I get, I guess, you know, when I was younger, a good horror film for me had to have a lot of gore and a lot of
high viscera. Body count. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And now I'm really starting to appreciate the psychological and the subdued and the subtle. And not that I didn't appreciate them, but I appreciate it more now. So when I have a film like this can be so unsettling and so creepy without having to resort to any of those
tricks of the trade.
Yeah. It's all the more impressive for me. So I would say this is an undersea masterpiece, and I would urge any of our listeners to seek out Pin.
Yeah.
Those that have seen it, I'm sure, are agreeing with us in our assessment of this film, and those that have not seen it.
So turn this into the cult classic per our discussion earlier then. Go out and see this if you haven't. You owe it to yourself to do so. And you owe it to yourself to check out our website, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. Follow us on Twitter, awful_movies. And we'll talk to you soon.
Take care. Thank you.